Welcome all the way back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. It is so cold. It is so cold. It's currently, let me type in weather here, 4 degrees. 4 degrees Celsius. It's freezing. Actually, it's 4 degrees above freezing, but it feels like it's freezing. I'm sure there's ice on things outside. How can there be icicles on things outside, which I'm sure there is, when it's technically not freezing? Had a top of 12 degrees today. 12 degree top Celsius. It's just not nice. Why isn't my password passwording? Okay, there we go. Madame Bovary. Part 3, Chapter 5 and a half. First half. Very beautiful descriptions in this chapter so far. What were your favourites? Swims to the Mumfishy, according to Corlett. Sorry, this is a Corlett comment. As Swims to the Mumfishy said early on, this book is well known for its use of free indirect style. Today, started paying a bit more attention to what that means and how it is used. So, here's what I found out on Wikipedia. Quoted or direct speech, he laid down his bundle and thought of his misfortune. And just what pleasure have I found since I came into this world, he asked. Reported or normal indirect speech, he laid down his bundle and thought of his misfortune. He asked himself what pleasure he had found since he came into the world. Free indirect speech is this. He laid down his bundle and thought of his misfortune, and just what pleasure had he found since he came into this world? Right. Okay. Free indirect speech. So it's their speaking, said by the narrator. Right. Okay. Which blurs the line between characters' opinions and neutral descriptions by the narrator. Very interesting. Oh man, there's a lot of really interesting conversation today. But having said that, I'm going to move on past this conversation about the indirect speech. Purely because it's so cold in my office that I want to finish this quickly. Acoustic Eel says, okay, random thing for me to fixate on at this point, but how does this carriage in the Hirudal work? Is it more like a bus or a taxi? I must have spaced out when they first introduced it. This guy, Hivert, owns it, and he goes into Rouen every Thursday at least with passengers. Do they pay him? If he's already going into town, it's not like he's making a special trip for the passengers. Some people are waiting for him, which makes it seem more like catching the bus. Was it common for villagers to have a designated driver for their trips? I know that public transit in the 1800s France may be a boring rabbit hole for some, but I'm American and our public transit is non-existent, especially in rural America, so I'm curious. Also sort of afraid that their public transit 150 years ago was better than ours now. Oh no. I've just cleared my throat and given myself the hiccups. That's so annoying. Why does that happen? Starfall 15 says, it must be like a bus system, but what I found curious is the driver knocking on doors to wake up passengers. It seems like France, they had several names, not only Le Hirondelle. Horse bus it was called. Very cool. It's a bus pulled by a horse. Laura Y. Stitch says, Emma swears on her child and then lies. More indication how little her daughter means to her, if we needed it. The description of the eyeless guy who follows the Hirondelle was quite terrifying. He reminded me, says Swims to the Mumfishy, he reminded me of the peasant guy that Anna and Vronsky both dreamt of in Anna Karenina. Yeah, what the hell, that little nightmarish bit of the last chapter where some dude with no eyes and the creepiest thing just latches on to the bus and what does he do? He like whips him to get him off it. It was just suddenly like a horror film briefly. Really, really strange. Why can't I log in? Apparently I can't log in to my, I can't log into Podbean, which is good. That's great. I love it. I love that. I love it when you can't log into the thing that you host your podcast on. That's good. I'm in now. Okay. Okay. Let's continue reading from yesterday. Part two of this chapter. It goes like this. Oh, yawning. Oh, it's cold and I'm tired. Ah, let's go. All right. Often when they talked of Paris, she ended by murmuring, ah, how happy we should be there. Are we not happy? Gently answered the young man, passing his hands over her hair. Yes, that is true, she said. I am mad. Kiss me. To her husband, she was more charming than ever. She made him pistachio creams and played him waltzes after dinner. So he thought himself the most fortunate of men, and Emma was without uneasiness when one evening, suddenly, he said, It is Mademoiselle Lempura, isn't it, who gives you lessons? Yes. Well, I saw her just now, Charles went on, at Madame Leogard's. I spoke to her about you, and she doesn't know you. This was like a thunderclap. However, she replied quite naturally, Ah, no doubt she forgot my name. But perhaps, said the doctor, there are several demoiselles Lempereur at Rouen who are music mistresses. Possibly, then quickly, but I have my receipts here, see? And she went to the writing table, ransacked all the drawers, rummaged the papers, and at last lost her head so completely that Charles earnestly begged her not to take so much trouble about those wretched receipts. Oh, I will find them, she said. And in fact, on the following Friday, as Charles was putting on one of his boots in the dark cabinet where his clothes were kept, he felt a piece of paper between the leather and his sock. He took it out and read, Received, for 3 months' lessons and several pieces of music, the sum of 63 francs. Felicity Lempura, Professor of Music. How the devil did it get into my boots? It must, she replied, have fallen from the old box of bills that is on the edge of the shelf. From that moment her existence was but one long tissue of lies, in which she enveloped her lover as in veils to hide it. It was a want, a mania, a pleasure carried to such an extent, that if she said she had the day before walked on the right side of the road, one might know she had taken the left. One morning, when she had gone, as usual, rather lightly clothed, it suddenly began to snow, and as Charles was watching the weather from the window, he caught sight of Monsieur Bernicien in the chaise of Monsieur Tuvache, who was driving him to Rouen. Then he went down to give the priest a thick shawl that he had to hand over to Emma as soon as she reached the Croix Rouge. When he got to the inn, Monsieur Bernicien asked for the wife of the Yonville doctor. The landlady replied that she very rarely came to her establishment. So that evening, when he recognized Madame Bovary in the Hirondelle, the cure told her this dilemma, without, however, appearing to attach much importance to it, for he began praising a preacher who was doing wonders at the cathedral, and whom all the ladies were rushing to hear. Still, he did not ask for any explanation. Others later on might prove less discreet. So he thought well to get down each time at the Croix Rouge, so that the good folk of her village who saw her on the stairs should suspect nothing. One day, however, Monsieur Leroux met her coming out of the Hotel de Boulogne on Leon's arm, and she was frightened, thinking he would gossip. He was not such a fool, but 3 days after he came to her room, shut the door, and said, I must have some money. She declared she could not give him any. Leroux burst into lamentations and reminded her of all the kindness he had shown her. In fact, of the two bills signed by Charles, Emma, up to the present, had paid only one. As to the second, the shopkeeper, at her request, had consented to replace it by another, which again had been renewed for a long date. Then he drew from his pocket a list of goods not paid for, to wit the curtains, the carpet, the material for the armchairs, several dresses, and divers articles of dress, the bills for which amounted to about 2,000 francs. She bowed her head and went on. But if you haven't any ready money, you have an estate. And he reminded her of a miserable little hovel situated at Barneville, near Almale, that brought in almost nothing. It had formerly been part of a small farm sold by Monsieur Bovary Senior, for Leroux knew everything, even to the number of acres and the names of the neighbours. If I were you in your place, he said, I should clear myself of my debts and have money left over. She pointed out the difficulty of getting a purchaser. He had held out the hope of finding one, but she asked him how she should manage to sell it. Haven't you your power of attorney? He replied. The phrase came to her like a breath of fresh air. Leave me the bill, said Emma. Oh, it isn't worth while, answered Leroux. He came back the following week and boasted of having, after much trouble, at last discovered a certain Langlois, who, for a long time, had had an eye on the property, but without mentioning his price. Never mind the price, she cried. But they would, on the contrary, have to wait to sound the fellow. The thing was worth a journey, and as she could not undertake it, he offered to go to the place to have an interview with Langlois. On his return, he announced that the purchaser proposed 4,000 francs. Emma was radiant at this news. Frankly, he added, that's a good price. She drew half the sum at once, and when he was about to pay her account, the shopkeeper said, It really grieves me, on my word, to see you depriving yourself all at once of such a big sum as that. Then she looked at the banknotes, and dreaming of the unlimited number of rendezvous represented by those 2,000 francs, she stammered, What? What? Oh, he went on, laughing good-naturedly, one puts anything one likes on receipts. Don't you think I know what household affairs are? And he looked at her fixedly, while in his hand he held two long papers that he slid between his nails. At last, opening his pocketbook, he spread out on the table four bills to order, each for 1,000 francs. Sign these, he said, and keep it all. She cried out, scandalized. But if I give you the surplus, replied Monsieur Leroux impudently, is that not helping you? And taking a pen, he wrote at the bottom of the account, Received of Madame Bovary 4,000 francs. Now, who can trouble you since in 6 months you'll draw the arrears for your cottage, and I don't make the last bill due till after you've been paid? Emma grew rather confused in her calculations, and her ears tingled as if gold pieces bursting from their bags rang all around her on the floor. At last Leroux explained that he had a very good friend, Vincart, a broker at Rouen, who would discount these four bills. Then he himself would hand over to Madame the remainder after the actual debt was paid. But instead of 2,000 francs, he brought only 1,800, for the friend, Vicart, which was only fair, had deducted 200 francs for commission and discount. Then he carelessly asked for a receipt. You understand in business sometimes, and with the date, if you please, with the date. A horizon of realizable whims opened out before Emma. She was prudent enough to lay by 1,000 crowns, with which the first three bills were paid when they fell due. But the fourth, by chance, came to the house on a Thursday, and Charles, quite upset, patiently awaited his wife's return for an explanation. If she had not told him about this bill, it was only to spare him such domestic worries. She sat on his knees, caressed him, cooed to him, gave him a long enumeration of all the dispensable things that had been got on credit. Really, you must confess, considering the quantity, it isn't too dear. Charles, at his wit's end, soon had recourse to the eternal Leroux, who swore he would arrange matters if the doctor would sign him two bills, on one of which was for several hundred francs, payable in 3 months. In order to arrange for this, he wrote his mother a pathetic letter. Instead of sending a reply, she came herself, and when Emma wanted to know whether he had got anything out of her, yes, he replied, but she wants to see the account. The next morning at daybreak, Emma ran to Leroux to beg him to make out another account for not more than 1,000 francs, for to show the one for 4,000, it would be necessary to say that she had paid 2/3 and confess, consequently, the sale of the estate, a negotiation admirably carried out by the shopkeeper, and which, in fact, was only actually known later on. Despite the low price of each article, Madame Bovary Senior, of course, thought the expenditure extravagant. Couldn't you do without a carpet? Why have you recovered the armchairs? In my time, there was a single armchair in a house for elderly persons, at any rate. It was so at my mother's, who was a good woman, I can tell you. Everybody can't be rich. No fortune can hold out against waste. I should be ashamed to coddle myself as you do. And yet I am old. I need looking after. And there, fitting up gowns, fallals. What, silk for lining at 2 francs, when you can get jaconet for 10 sous, or even for 8. That would do well enough. Emma, lying on a lounge, replied as quietly as possible, "Ah, madam, enough, enough." The other went on lecturing her, predicting they would end in the workhouse, but it was Bovary's fault. Luckily, he had promised to destroy that power of attorney. What? Ah, he swore he would, went on the good woman. Emma opened the window, called Charles, and the poor fellow was obliged to confess the promise torn from him by his mother. Emma disappeared, then came back quietly and majestically handed her a thick piece of paper. "Thank you," said the old woman, and she threw the power of attorney into the fire. Emma began to laugh, a strident, piercing, continuous laugh. She had an attack of hysterics. "Oh, my God," cried Charles. "Ah, you really are wrong. You came here to make scenes with her." His mother, shrugging her shoulders, declared it was all put on. But Charles, rebelling for the first time, took his wife's part so that Madame Bovary Senior said she would leave. She went the very next day, and on the threshold, as he was trying to detain her, she replied, "No, no, you love her better than me, and you are right. It is natural. For the rest, so much the worse. You will see. Good day, for I am not likely to come again soon. As you say, to make scenes." Charles, nevertheless, was very crestfallen before Emma. He did not hide the resentment she still felt. Who did not hide the resentment she still felt at his want of confidence, and it needed many prayers before she would consent to have another power of attorney. He even accompanied her to Monsieur Guillaumin to have a second one, just like the other, drawn up. "I understand," said the notary. "A man of science can't be worried with the practical details of life." And Charles felt relieved by this comfortable reflection, which gave his weakness the flattering appearance of higher preoccupation. And what an outburst the next Thursday at the hotel room in their room with Leon. She laughed, cried, sang, sent for sherbets, wanted to smoke cigarettes, seemed to him wild and extravagant, but adorable, superb. He did not know what recreation of her whole being drove her more and more to plunge into the pleasures of life. She was becoming irritable, greedy, voluptuous, and she walked about the streets with him, carrying her head high, without fear, so she said, of compromising herself. At times, however, Emma shuddered at the sudden thought of meeting Rudolph, for it seemed to her that although they were separated forever, she was not completely free from her subjugation to him. One night she did not return to Yonville at all. Charles lost his head with anxiety, and little Bert, who would not go to bed without her mamma, sobbed enough to break her heart. Justin had gone out searching the road at random. Monsieur Hermès even had left his pharmacy. At last, at 11 o'clock, able to bear it no longer, Charles harnessed his chaise, jumped in, whipped up his horse, and reached the Croix Rouge at about 2 o'clock in the morning. No one there. He thought that the clerk had perhaps seen her, but where did he live? Happily, Charles remembered his employer's address and rushed off there. Day was breaking, and he could distinguish the escutcheons over the door, and knocked. Someone without opening the door shouted out the required information, adding a few insults to those who disturb people in the middle of the night. The house inhabited by the clerk had neither bell, knocker, nor porter. Charles knocked loudly at the shutters with his hands. A policeman happened to pass by. Then he was frightened and went away. "I am mad," he said. "No doubt they kept her to dinner at Monsieur Lumeau." But the Lormeau no longer lived at Rouen. She probably stayed to look after Madame Dubreuil. Why, Madame Dubreuil has been dead these 10 months. Where can she be? An idea occurred to him. At a cafe he asked for a directory and hurriedly looked for the name of Mademoiselle L'Empereur, who lived at number 74 Rue de la Renelle des Maroquiniers. As he was turning into the street, Emma herself appeared at the other end of it. He threw himself upon her rather than embracing her, crying, "What kept you yesterday?" "I was not well." "What was it? Where? How?" She passed her hand over her forehead and answered, "At Mademoiselle L'Empereur's." "I was sure of it. I was going there." Oh, it isn't worthwhile, said Emma. She went out just now, but for the future, don't worry. I do not feel free, you see, if I know that these least delays upset you like this. This was a sort of permission that she gave herself, so as to get perfect freedom in her escapades, and she profited by it freely, fully. When she was seized with the desire to see Leon, she set out upon her any pretext, and as he was not expecting her on that day, she went to fetch him at his office. It was a great delight at first, but soon he no longer concealed the truth, which was that his master complained very much about these interruptions. "Sure, come along," she said, and he slipped out. She wanted him to dress all in black and grow a pointed beard to look like the portraits of Louis XIII. She wanted to see his lodgings, thought them poor. He blushed at them, but she did not notice this, then advised him to buy some curtains like hers, and as he objected to the expense, you care for your money, she said, laughing. Each time Leon had to tell her everything that he had done since their last meeting, she asked him for some verses for herself, a love poem in honour of her. But he never succeeded in getting a rhyme for the second verse, and at last ended by copying a sonnet in the Keepsake. This was less from vanity than from the one desire for pleasing her. He did not question her ideas, accepted all her tastes. He was rather becoming her mistress than she his. She had tender words and kisses that thrilled his soul. Where could she have learnt this corruption, almost incorporeal in the strength of its profanity and dissimulation? Dissimulation. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Strong ending there with a word that I can't pronounce. Thanks very much for listening. I will see you tomorrow.